That was cool.
So wonderful. Boy, that brought me
back.
What was that like to be back? I mean, again, you heard this stuff when it was just piano, or it was just, and then hear it pared down again.
It was very moving for me, especially the end, the last sequence, the goodbye spot, a moment that he played, just because the last time I had heard it was in the booth at Warner Brothers when they kind of played it for the film. And, you know, it is an art form that I greatly respect, and they gave this to us for our film. And to hear literally our maestros play it with their hearts, amazing.
So from your side of the thing, can you talk about how you work the Venn diagram? Because face it,
of course.
A boy and his dog story, an epic adventure, a comedy, a road picture, and and score that, go.
Exactly how you're saying it, like I really focused on the relationship first. There was just like Arlo's growth and this catalyst of Spot that helps him through that. And that was the first thing that I pitched to Michael and just talked about that. And look, I never worked with a composer like this before. I always thought, do I need to know a lot about the music language? And like, fortissimo, like, you know, I didn't know that well. But when I started talking to him about the emotions of the movie, he immediately connected to that. And that began our language in terms of the Venn diagram where our places crossed. It was definitely the emotions of the film that he really wanted to focus on with me. You know, that's exactly what I wanted. But it was kind of a leap of faith because I was showing him literally like drawings of like, okay, so there's a dinosaur here, and there's Spot. The background's going to be beautiful, though. The background's going to be gorgeous. We just have these rough drawings I know, and like, that's a dinosaur? Yeah, that's a dinosaur, and he's walking in this woods, and he's just like, okay, I don't really normally work like this. We work with footage and stuff like that, and it was just like, yeah, but you got to trust me because we don't have a lot of time. You're just going to have to. And then when he played music for us, it was very digital, and it was just a simple theme like you're saying, and so he was doing the same thing, like, you're going to just have to trust me because when this is played with 40 violins and this thing, it's just going to sound totally different. Like, okay. And so it was that type of back and forth.
What was everyone has a moment in the film, and I know this is your project, but there has to be something that stuck out that, like, it hit every single note for you. Like, yes, this is the moment of the film that, like, touched your heart, even though that you were there from the beginning of the process.
Yeah.
In the final product, what was that?
I would have to say that last piece of music, it was one of the, you know, we always knew that that Arlo's last step to maturation was going to be letting go of his, quote-unquote, magic feather, you know, like, can I let this kid go and become stronger for it, you know, and we had this scene really early on, and it was something that I talked to Michael about, and I was so sensitive to it. And when he played the music for the first time, I was in tears. I just was. And, you know, we had it at an early, you know, kind of rough sequence that he put the music to. But as the sequence evolved and the animators put their work into it and the lighting put their work into it, and then finally being on the stage when finally that picture is up on a big screen and right below it are a whole group of other artists trying to merge this emotion to it. It was that really hit me hard.
The concept of Pixar doing a dinosaur,
sure,
it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, I was almost surprised it took until now to make one. But that being said, was the linchpin for you as a storyteller the father-son aspect? Was that what you honed in on, is that this is the part that's going to be universal and emotional and audiences are going to connect with?
Yeah, more than the father-son story, it was understanding that Arlo had a hole in his life that Spot needed to fill. That became the thing for me. Understanding what loss is was something that me and the story team took very seriously because it had been done before, and you know, and how do you present that in a way that is different, you know? And for Arlo, you know, the whole metaphor of being called a dinosaur, you know, is just like, you're a dinosaur, meaning you're stuck in the past and you're unable to move forward, you're a Luddite. Knowing that Arlo was that because of the loss of his father, that he was unable to move forward emotionally, just couldn't, it stunted him, essentially. And I know I'm just talking, like, whatever, metaphorically, but that's what Spot was there for. That when I understood that, like, he has this hole in his life and he needed someone to help him learn to move forward and heal, that was the simple little chemistry thing of like, okay, that's what this film is about, you know. And so by the time that we get to that end scene, that you realize that Arlo has been fulfilled by Spot, and he's able to say, you know, your love will stay with me. This is better for you. And yeah, and so it went that way.
Did you recognize that early on in the process? Was that something that you found through the process?
A half and half.
Okay.
The idea of the hole and the killing of the father was really early on. How Spot would fill that out, you know, I honestly had no idea. That really came through the evolution of just the Pixar way that they tell the process there. And the process is violent. It's a very violent process there in terms of you put a story up and then you just said, like, that didn't work. All those weeks, take it out. And then you put it up again. Let's do a whole other version. And you put it up again, and then you take it down. And usually, you know, these films take about 4 to 5 years. We did this under 2 years in terms of getting that up, and it was just a lot of countless hours of just trying to get that going. And I'm not complaining or anything, but just knowing that that's one of the great things about Pixar is that the people there have this ability to put their heart out there, get it stomped on and ripped apart, and then go, here's my heart again, which is something that, like, it moves me to this day.
Going off of that, how did you find the balance with Spot between human and dog?
Yeah.
Because there's a little bit of both in there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, clearly it's a little bit more of a dog scenario.
Yeah. It was all about understanding what I needed from the dog aspect of Spot. Spot, I just wanted to be kind of like this little chaplain-esque street urchin that has just been growing up, surviving out in the wilderness. But what does that mean? Like, and so, you know, you could have a human doing that. But why someone like, why an animal like a dog? There's an unpredictability factor, and there's there are all these qualities to the animal that was necessary, because if we could make you feel that Spot made animal decisions, then when we started to play the cards that he is something more, you could feel it. And it's very subtle. You know, like when Spot bites the head off, it's, you know, of this bug in the movie, it's a shocking thing, but that was something that we felt from animals, that they're so unpredictable, you know. Can't tell you how many stories I've had when I dog sit for. There's another director at Pixar, Mark Andrews, who directed Brave, and he's this kind of gregarious guy, and his dogs are exactly the same. They're all like gregarious dogs, and I remember house sitting for him, and those dogs, like, you know, are so unpredictable. They just like ran outside the backyard and they attacked a bush. I'm like, what's going on? And then they come back and they had blood on their noses, and the possum came out of the bush, and it was like, holy cow! But, like, you know, there was a truth to that in terms of my understanding of what an animal was. And so it was really trying to find that animal quality, because slowly, in the beginning it was just jokes, but then as we got into it, it really kind of discovered a whole other human side that was really cool for us. In one of my favorite moments in the movie, Arlo is explaining to Spot that he misses his family, and we're doing all this work to make you feel like, when, like, this dog is like, I don't understand you, and then, like, getting down on all fours. But then when Spot goes away and it starts to communicate that he has lost too, he does this little gesture that's like this. It's very subtle, but it's a very human gesture, and it's the first one in the movie where we start to turn it. And so there was a lot of effort to get there, as subtle as it was.
Of course, it is a long process, but what were you having clear starting from the beginning?
Yeah, what was I having, yeah. What was clear for me from the beginning? The heart of this film that I wanted to do from Bob's original pitch of the boy and dog story. Also trying to not have an ending that was just another carnivore attacking, you know, another dinosaur, trying to find something emotional with that. And that really was making nature more of a character. As realistic as it was, we really tried to have it support and be an antagonist to Arlo's journey. You know, for example, the river, when Arlo is, terrified and scared, that river was roiling, you know. And then when he starts to connect to Spot, the river starts to calm down and then becomes like glass and more peaceful. But then on the other end, you know, we just tried a lot to do, to make nature a part of this thing. But those were some of the tenets early on.
Can you talk a little bit about the collector? Because, again, that's such a fun
vignette
in the movie. But it's, you know, looking at that, you know, there's like the Mountain Men and Jeremiah Johnson, where you have,
they come out of the woodworks, and you're like, where have you been?
You know, where the idea, because I love that it suddenly goes left with the whole, all of his spirit animals that really don't seem to do anything at all.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, the Jeremiah Johnson was a huge influence on us in terms of our survival movie and making a movie that was about that test, that survival test. Mm-hmm. All the characters we've really based off of Arlo's journey. This character would be based as Arlo. What if Arlo did get stuck out there and lived there forever, what would he turn into? And so he became a character of just living in fear his whole life, so fearful that he went crazy, you know, and so that everything that he has is to protect him from all his fears. As crazy as those fears are, it was all based on that simple concept of, like, what if Arlo came face to face with himself, essentially, if he went down this road of living in fear his whole life? And that character also gives advice, like, you have to keep that protector with you this whole time, which is the wrong advice, you know. And but then there was the goofy side that we thought was so funny about him, was that all his spirit animals were just, you know, protecting nothing, essentially, you know, these weird esoteric things. But it came from that. It came from that idea. And these kind of in the frontier stories, those weird guys that have just been living on their own forever and that are not, you know, they don't ever make movies about.
And who pushed back and said, you should do the voice?
Yeah, that was all John Lasseter. I really didn't want to do it, only because this is my first time directing. I'm like, I can't direct myself, John. I'm just going to, you know, we'll find a real actor to do this, you know. And I kept telling him, like, you know, let me, every time I pitched it, he was just like, you're hilarious, you've got to do it. And I'm like, no, we'll find an actor. And the next time I pitch it, you got to do it. I'm like, no, you're doing it. Okay, you got it, John, whatever you want to do. And then so much so that he directed me to do that. And so he was great. I had never worked with him in that way before. I only worked with him in story functions or developing stuff. And so watching him in his direction priorities were a lot of lessons for me that I also used in directing, you know.
Can I ask you about working with John?
Sure.
On the subject, just because, you know, 20 years ago, Pixar movies were distinctly different than Disney animated films.
Yes.
And now the lines are very blurred.
Sure.
You really can't tell.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
So, I mean, I call that the Lasseter effect, right?
Sure.
The John being in charge of all of it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Is that really what you would attribute it to?
To John's tastes, you mean, in terms of...
And the fact that both companies within the company now are kind of on the same page as opposed to doing different types of movies.
Yeah, you know, more than anything, the thing that I learned the most about this project is that John really does, you know, when he says it's director-driven, you know, a lot of that responsibility landed on me. Even though I was a new guy, even though I was untested, you know, he believed in the process enough to say, okay, you know, this is, okay, I see what you're doing with that. I give you advice to say that works and that I don't know about. But it is still ultimately up to you as the director. And so a lot of these films, when you look at them, you know, the ones that are feel like John, and most of them are feel like John because he's either directed them or really been a bigger part of them, like The Cars, French Was a Bug's Life, or Toy Story. Those are all John. You know, but when you see Finding Nemo, that is very Andrew. You know, that is so him. And then Incredibles is so Brad. And obviously the Pete Docter movies, that is Pete. And so it's just a testament to John's ability to let the directors kind of let their voices come through in their way, you know. Like I know that it's still a collaborative effort, but I would say the same thing is true for Disney, that John is putting that same imprint of, like, you know, the directors down there from Rich Moore coming up with Wreck-It Ralph. Doesn't feel like a Pixar movie in a way, but it kind of does, because there's still that JL influence, but it still very much feels like a Rich Moore movie when you get to meet him. Or the other directors there, they all, you know, Don Hall was a story teacher of mine at CalArts, and him and Chris Williams, I could definitely feel them in those movies. And so, more than anything, I feel like it's a testament that John continues to allow the directors to be, and kind of pull what is good out of those guys, if that makes sense.
Yeah, perfect. That's a great answer.
I think throughout this whole situation, I've been saying that the scene where Arlo loses his pops reminds me of the scene from Lion King.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, would you say that heavily influenced your process?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it heavily influenced the process, but I knew it was out there. But, like, boy, trying to get something, like, you know, there were so many routes that we had gone. And I never wanted to echo it, but, you know, after the movie's been out, I got a lot of that. And they were just like, boy, I never wanted that to be, like, the echo of The Lion King, for sure. Only because there were a lot of movies that I had grown up with that had that kind of power to it. Like Bambi, I remember the death of the family. They did it, you know, without seeing anything. You just heard the shotgun in a very elegant way. And it's a very archetypal story, so I just kept believing in that. But The Lion King, you know, because it's a father-son story, definitely echoed in a way that I was more surprised about than anything.
So would you say it's the subconscious coming through?
Maybe, yeah. I just knew that, like, we really needed to feel that father, you know, and what he represented in Arlo's life. You know, because there were versions of the movie where Dad was an angel. He could do no wrong. Mm-hmm. And then when he died, it was just like, okay, boy. Yeah, the angel died. That's just like, and then, yeah, exactly. And then so we look to our own lives, and like, and as me as a father, I remember my daughter sucking her thumb, and then like, you know, like, stop sucking your thumb. I'm just gonna bite it off if you don't stop. And her reacting and like immediately crying to that, and I was just like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I love you so much. And I'm like, why? What am I afraid of? What am I? As a dad, what do I give a shit about, like, you sucking your thumb? You can do whatever you want. I love you. Be who you are. And I'm trying to inject that into that dad and trying to find ways that, like, you know, so in the movie, you know, Arlo has a job that his father gave, but he messes it up. And then the dad, like, immediately is like, you're coming out with me. I'm going to teach you a lesson. You grab that gun. We're going to go shoot that deer right now. And then when he goes out there into the woods, knowing that he's pushed it too far with his son, that he's crossed the line, and that immediate kind of like, I'm so sorry, you know, I just want what's best for you, essentially. And then nature saying, that's it for your dad, you know. Nature is now going to take away someone that cares for you and believes in you. And how does Arlo move on from that? But it was all staying as honest like as I could to the story that this film was telling me that it wanted to be, you know what I mean? It's a weird phenomenon, I got to tell you, because so much of it in the beginning is like, you got to be this, you got to be this story, you got to do this. And then at a certain point, it's just like, no, what? You're like, I need to be this. And you're like, whoa, okay. And it begins to talk to you. I know that sounds crazy.
No, I get it. Is this your first child?
Yeah, this is my first film, yeah, for sure. Oh, Vivian? Yes, yeah.
You're first to both.
The other child.
Yeah, both kids were born during this production. When Bob first asked me to come on, which was like a little bit over 5 or 6 years ago, a year into that production, I had Vivian, and then I had Sam, who's now 3, and it was amazing. But boy, my growth through this whole thing, from as an artist and as a parent, it was just insane. So as a milestone, this movie in my life has means a lot. Just
how did
ridiculous.
The kids enjoy the film?
They, you know, it's so funny that I was worried about Sam because he's 3 years old. Like, is this too scary for Sam? He's 3. And there are moments in the movie where he held onto my wife a little tighter, but he didn't look away, because most of the movies that I've seen, like, I remember seeing, Dumbo with it. And then, like, he got really scared at this fire sequence. I'm like, boy, that's not that scary at all. I don't know how he's going to deal with this movie. And I said, no, he really wants to see it. I'm like, okay. But he stuck to the whole thing, and he loves it. And Sam, Vivian loves it too. They continually draw it. The most emotional thing for me was that when I got home, I don't know, a couple weeks after they had seen the movie, Vivian, my daughter, made a book of Arlo's journey. You know, like Arlo on the farm, and then like Arlo with the chickens. You know, I'm like, ah. And then Arlo falling in the river, and then Arlo finding Spot, and then Arlo growing, and then saying goodbye. And I was like, oh my goodness, you've got that whole movie in your head. That's amazing. And it was emotional. It's really cool. Yeah.
Are you thinking about making the Good Dinosaur 2, maybe?
I have not thought about it. The last time I thought about that was during the making of like trying to come up with backstories of like how to support who that family was that Spot meets at the end of the movie, who are all these things. But that was the only time we ever thought about it. But at this point, you know, it is a child that has gone off to college. If he returns from college to do his laundry, I will talk to him and see what else is up, but we'll see what happens.
What kind of extra stuff are we going to have on the Blu-ray?
A lot of stuff of the research that we had done. There was especially this family called the McKays that greatly influenced me and the film. Like, I was talking about parenting. This is two older white couple from Texas that adopted 5 Haitian kids. And the way this father taught these kids this life in love was so inspiring to me. I didn't realize how much of a helicopter parent I was, you know, with my kids. That I was literally like, okay, Sam, I can do that for you. Oh, you're crying? Let me do that for you. I can take care of that. But this dad literally told his, you know, sons and daughters, like, I'm going to show you this once, and that's it. And then, like, he showed them this stuff. And then he was doing that to me when we were out there. He'd throw me a rope and go catch a horse. And, like, I could barely grab a taxi versus go catch a horse. And so he was literally teaching me in that same way that he taught his kids, through respect, but also, and so it just, boy, I said, I want to live my life like this guy. I can't believe how well this family works, and love, and every member is functioning in a way that I really wanted to capture in the film. And yeah, and so there's stuff like that. The music is a big part of the documentary as well. I mean, the extras, and there's some deleted scenes from previous versions of the movie that are in there. And yeah, I think they did a really good job on some of those documentaries. And so, and also, I think one of the documentaries, because I've been getting a lot of tweets and emails about, where the hell is the Pizza Planet truck? Where is all those extra stuff? And I think one of the documentaries literally has like where they are. And so, yeah.
How much of your own family life was incorporated in this? I mean, you mentioned the guy from the white guy with the Haitian kids.
Yeah.
But you know, you bring a part of yourself into this no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where from your upbringing and your family outlook, you know, from your dad into your relationship,
yeah,
did you incorporate into the film?
Yeah, you know, my dad came to the States in the 70s to make his own life, you know, and he had a grocery store. And it's I remember sitting with him at 4 in the morning where he went to the Bronx Terminal Market to bring vegetables, and then his job was done at 11 o'clock at night. I never saw him. But, you know, during the day, I mean, I did see him, but, like, we all worked together, and that concept of a whole family working together to survive in the city was something that is a part of my life. But then when I started meeting all these farmers and ranchers, it was the same thing. You just take out the city. Mm-hmm. That there was the same family that was all working together to survive on thousands of acres of land in the middle of the wilderness, you know. And so, but that I connected to that strongly. And so when we were talking about farmers, it was like, okay, we have a farm family that's surviving on their own out there. No one else to help them. They're doing it on their own. And there's one member of that family that just doesn't feel like he can help out. And I remember feeling that a great deal, you know, and the responsibility that my father had to kind of help us all out was just woven in there through the storytelling process. But I mean, look, I can't tell you how much of a therapy process it is to sit in a room with everyone and go, okay, boy, Arlo's got a spot hole in his life. I don't understand the steps of maturity here. You know what? These are the steps. Like, we have to first throw him out there and go into the wilderness. Boy, I remember the first time I went out there, the noise level of the woods at night just really freaked me out. And then everyone was like, you know, the first time my dad took me camping. So all of a sudden you start talking about it, and then it builds to, and then my dad, you know, then he got my first fish and I hadn't seen him for years. And then, you know, it just turns into these things that you try to put into the movie as best as you can.
And what did your dad think of the movie after all?
He really loved it. I was just talking about this kind of, like, he saw it in 3D, though, and he had never seen a 3D movie, so he was just blown away by the concept of, like, the mountains felt so far away in his, like, broken English, like, and the rocks are so close. And I'm like, yeah, Dad, that's the 3D aspect. What do you think of the movie? Yes, but the water was right here, like, in your eyes, and the trees were really right there. And I'm like, but what did you think of the movie, Dad? And he's like, oh, very pretty, very good. And then I'm like, oh, I don't know if he even, you know. But then they saw it again with family without the 3D, and we had a long discussion that he loved it and my mom loved it, and it was very emotional. Just to, you know, how often can you say, hey, Dad, this is a movie that we made. You know, you should see it. And, you know, my dad, most movies that I grew up with him, he was literally like, you know, through every theater experience that I ever had with him.
Now, speaking of which, though, the you've directed a movie at Pixar.
Yeah.
So, and again, I know you've been out pounding, you know, the drum promoting this.
Yeah.
Are you ready to direct again, or?
Yeah, you know what? It's half and half. Like, there's a fire that's always been there that is now stoked to just, like, get onto the next thing. But then there's another thing. Because I had two kids, my wife literally has been taking care, like, doing a lot of heavy lifting at home that I have not been a part of. And so I owe her a great deal. And so once I somehow pay that back, I don't know if I can. I have no idea. I know, you're laughing. I'm just saying, like, there's just like, I'm going to try to do my best to just do something in honor of that and then get back into the filmmaking again. But the people at Pixar have been so supportive. They're like, whenever you come back, you know, like, we know that you need to heal stuff at home, do that. But then when you get back, you know, these are some of the things that we want you to, you know, get in on when you start developing something. And so that's next.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very
cool.
The voices, do you have any actors in mind with the process, or everything was set after?
Kind of both. Because this film was a whole other movie before, there was already a cast that was connected to it. The only one that we kind of stuck with was with Frances McDormand, only because she still had more of a frontier kind of thing that she could do, even though it's not a strong frontier accent. The other film had nothing to do with, like, the frontier. But Arlo was an older character. He was like about 25. He was like this man child. But then one of my things that when I wanted to jump on was really kind of tell an honest coming of age story. So we made him younger. Once we made him younger, that kind of changed the rest of the cast. Because we had like Bill Hader as one of Arlo's brothers, and we had a whole cast. But then once we made him younger, all the other kids had to get younger too, or the siblings, and that just changed everything. And so we had to just kind of redo most of everything in a short amount of time.
We have time for one last question.
So where does the idea of putting some Far West atmosphere came from?
Really from where we found dinosaur bones. All the dinosaur bones in America are all found in like Montana and like Wyoming, and which was so interesting that like, and all these, everywhere you would go, it's like, you know, John Ford shot here in Utah, or John Ford, you know, or like George Stevens Jr. shot right here in the Teton Valley, you know, ranch here in Wyoming. And you're just like, boy, the West and the dinosaurs are all kind of speaking to me here. And then the idea of an herbivore becoming a farmer also triggered the idea of carnivores becoming ranchers, that they would live their life that way also, all struggling, all trying to survive in this type of wilderness, that everywhere you went, there were just stories of like, many families died here to try to cross this pass, or many family died here because the soil was just not strong enough, and you're just like, holy cow, this transcontinental, I mean not transcontinental, but like the, you know, the continental, what is it, the shift there, what is that?
The northern passage? Well, the heading west?
Yeah, the Lois and Clark and like all that stuff, Lois. That would be home.
Lois and Clark
thing. Yeah, Lois and Clark.
Entirely different.
Yeah. No, but that idea of survival just is a part of the Western kind of... Like, look, the first version of this movie was so such a cliche. It was just like the T-Rexes were like J.R., J.W., and J.L., and they're just out. They're not a family. They're just doing their thing, and there's a saloon, and there was like a sheriff in town, and like, Arlo, you get on this town. And it was just like, ugh, this is what we're doing. And then we just stripped it all out, and when we did all the research, we just found these hardworking families. That's all it was out there. And we just that's what I connected to because of my upbringing with my family working hard. And
the covered wagon.
The covered wagon trail. Yeah, the Oregon Trail. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Thanks, you guys. Thank you very
much.
Thank you very much.
This was fun.
What is this?